Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 16, 2002, EIR's founding editor, Lyndon LaRouche, addressed the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute and International Caucus of Labor Committees. This week, we bring you a continuation of LaRouche's remarks to the Assembly, including answers to questions from the international audience.
Now, this is a condition which would the United States economy reach during the spring of year 2000. In this point, the amount of financial aggregate which had to be poured into the economy under the Clinton program of plunge protection, the amount of aggregate that had to be poured in to keep the stock market and related financial markets from collapsing exceeded the amount of endangered financial assets which needed to be rolled over. This is exactly what happened to Germany in June, July of 1923, in which the German bank had to print money more rapidly than was accounted for by the amount of assets it was rolling over. And that led to hyperinflation. So at this point, the U.S. financial system in the spring and summer of 2000 went into a hyperinflationary mode. The real economy was collapsing at an accelerating rate. Look at the layoffs. Look at the shutdowns now ongoing. The physical economy is collapsing at an accelerating rate. The financial aggregate system, the market, is not. It is now collapsing. That is the rate of expansion of financial market values on stock markets and similar exchanges is not rising at the rate it was. And since the value of these so-called assets was based on the rate of growth, a slowing of the rate of growth means an inevitable slowing and dropping of the yield on these investments. At the same time, to maintain these levels of investments by cutting interest rates, for example, Federal Reserve interest rates, the amount of money that has to be poured in is greater than the amount of financial assets being supported, subsidized by money printing. Now, the money printing is both U.S. and it comes from places like Japan. The Japan yen, the U.S. dollar, hangs on the Japan yen. The Japan government and banking system has been printing money for the benefit of the United States. It has been loaning that money at 0% or nearly 0% borrowing cost. Can you borrow at 0%? Right. This money is then used to buy, issued as yen alone. The yen are then used to buy dollars, euros, and so forth. This money then comes back into the United States, into the U.S. financial market, and pumps up the U.S. financial market. Keep it up there for a minute. It pumps up the financial market. So what happens if the yen collapses? What happens if the yen collapses? Argentina's bankrupt, and so forth and so on. What happens if Turkey collapses? It's already as bankrupt as Argentina. It's just being supported for military purposes, as in the case of Iraq operations in Central Asia. What happens? The entire system then goes into a chain reaction collapse. Now, that's not the end of it. Now we get back to cluster buster. Now, this whole system of Enron and what it typifies was one gigantic swindle. There was never any merit to it. It was pure theft. It had another aspect of pumping to it. Enron and similar kinds of firms were giving contributions to finance election campaigns and party finances. So this money was going in to buy congressmen. And as the value of the congressman went lower and lower, the price went up. So how do they maintain the system? There was never any value in this system. It was pure theft and swindle. And there is nothing but criminality in this whole thing. Leading accounting firms? Can you trust an accounting firm? Would you trust a leading accounting firm? Would you trust a banker? Would you trust a congressman? What they invested in was, they invested in what's called hedges. And what they would do is take a stream of money and make a deal with each other, a bunch of people. And these hedges became more and more complicated, and more of the world, especially in the funny money area, became involved in deals with each other. Now, the security for all of these notional values on financial derivatives is not based on real assets. It's based on the assumption that Joe Doakes is going to be able to pay Joe Schmo. And if Joe Doakes commits suicide, then Joe Schmo goes bankrupt. Now, if you have a system of this type in which all of these characters are in these partnership deals, derivatives partnerships, counterparty relationships, and they're entangled like the biggest, dirtiest spider web you ever imagined, what happens is, when it starts to collapse, the whole thing comes down in a chain reaction collapse. What we're dealing with now is over $100 trillion of notional values in derivatives sitting on top of a bubble in which there's global crossing and so forth. Many of these things are like that, are in the Bermudas or the Jersey Islands and so forth. They're purely shell operations. Many companies in the United States have become entangled in energy deals and also derivatives agreements, including like one in Pennsylvania recently, which just went under. A power company, which is not engaged in derivatives as such, became involved and entangled in these contracts with Enron, as they were going under. So what you have now is you're at the verge of a chain reaction. Now, I'll tell you what this is like, to give an image. There's a critter in nature, very interesting critter, which sometimes acts like an animal and sometimes acts like a plant, sort of like an Enron executive. It is called a slime mold. There are many kinds of slime molds, and you're going to see a picture on the internet of this. We're putting one on this at this point in this address I'm making. We're going to stick it in on the web at that point, so people can see what I'm talking about a slime mold. What happens is this thing, which you find in swamp waters and things like that, in one phase of its existence, it's running around like individuals and behaving like an animal. At another point, all these animals come together in a cluster, and they form a real piece of slime, ugly slime. And this is what's called a slime mold. It goes through these two phases, back and forth. Well, there's only us individual partners here in Enron, right? Then you start looking at the partnerships. You say, wait a minute, this is a slime mold. Then you look at the counterparty relationships which Enron has through these financial derivatives market with this totality, and you say, we got $100 trillion notional value slime mold which is sitting on top of the world and suffocating it. Did you ever see a slime mold die? They do sometimes. And that's the problem we're facing with right now. That's what I mean by the cluster buster, and but clusters last stand. We're at that point. There is nothing left to support this. Production is down. The system is collapsing. It's finished. And this is what I've seen, foreseen, and this is what I presented with this 1995, 1996, and again with the second phase in 2000 on the question of this triple curve. This is the nature of the situation. We're at the end. Now, what is this? This is a classical tragedy. Now, contrary to what many of you may have had, who still had an education in days where they used to teach Shakespeare and things in universities and high schools, when people knew something, in those days, you were mistaught about a tragedy. And you had the usual romantic interpretation of tragedy. The explanation was that Hamlet failed. Hamlet made a mistake, and that caused Denmark to get wiped out in that period. Not true. Hamlet didn't make a mistake. The only thing that would have saved Denmark was Hamlet would have made a mistake. What Hamlet did, and this is summed up in two locations, in the famous third act soliloquy, to be or not to be, and then again in the closing scene of the play, where you have this peculiar skewed dialogue between the Norwegian prince and Horatio, in which the prince is saying, let's go on and do more of this. They're carrying Hamlet off stage dead, and a lot of other corpses are being carried off stage dead. And here he's saying, Fortinbras is saying, let's have more of this. Horatio says, let's stop and think now on what has happened so we don't do this some more. Then you go back to the third act soliloquy. Fernando and Hamlet. I thought you'd like that. Third act soliloquy, and Hamlet is saying, I know what to do, but I got to think about, what if I die? What if it doesn't work? So I'm going to go back and do what I think I'm going to conduct myself the way I was trained to act. Now, in every tragedy, it's the same thing. Every true tragedy, the death of a nation is caused not by its leader or the failure of its leader as such. The failure of the nation is caused by the people. And the failure of the leader is he does not go against the will of the people. There is no, in point of fact, in real history, the failure of all pragmatists. Every pragmatist is a potential walking tragedy. Because no culture, no civilization was ever destroyed by itself, except by its own opinion, except by adapting to its own popular opinion. The leader who fails, the tragic figure, is the leader who does exactly as popular opinion demands. And the people that fail are those who choose leaders who are slaves to popular opinion. That is the tragedy of the United States today. That is why none of the two major parties work. That is why they're failures. Because as long as people go by popular opinion in the United States is to that degree doomed. Only a sudden and revolutionary change in popular opinion can save the United States from hell at this point. And hell is looking at us in the form of this Clash of Civilizations war. Europe is about to distance itself from the United States. It may not do it, but it's at the threshold of threatening to do something it has not threatened to do in more than five decades. Break from the power of the United States. Because Europe knows the United States is doomed and wonders if it has the guts to break from that doom. That's the reality. Because all the solutions would mean a violation of popular opinion. It would mean saying that your friend who believed in the new economy was a suicidal idiot. That your friend who believed in free trade was a tragic idiot. That your friend who believed in globalization was a tragic idiot. Your friend who believed that you had to go by popular opinion or popular opinion polls was a tragic idiot. When you find the whole nation is behaving like a horde of mythical lemmings about to go over the cliff, you don't want to follow lemming opinion. If you care about lemmings, you're going to try to get them to change their opinion, and you're going to be very rude when it comes to discussing their present opinions. That's the challenge that faces us. I watched this. I've been around for a fairly long time. I'm still frisky, along with a couple of other people like Bill, you know. We're still frisky. We're still able to do our job. But a lot of other people have passed on. And we're among the survivors, people like me, my position. We know what happened to this country in the 1920s, the 1930s, during the war, the immediate post-war period, the 1950s and the 1960s, and we know what happened since. Most people in positions of power today who are members of the baby boomer generation, that is, who were born during or after World War II, have not a clue as to what has been going on in the world in this period, because they were raised as children under the influence of what we called then McCarthyism. It was actually Trumanism, but somebody decided to call it McCarthyism. They couldn't pronounce Truman. And under this thing, parents would tell their children, get out of the cities, get out in the suburbs, get a white-collar job, get away from those blue-collar jobs, get out there and get behind a desk, not a machine tool. Don't get your hands dirty. There's no future in that. That's for poor people, not for you. Go to the right schools. Be careful what you say. Never say things that might get back and get our family into trouble. Don't say something that might result as your father being fired as an engineer at that plant. Learn to go along, to get along. And so it's not the baby boomer's fault in the sense. They were raised that way. They don't know any better. They were never educated any better. When they're faced with something they don't want to face, they say, I don't go there. Don't tell me about that. I don't want to hear it. I'm not going there. I don't go there. I don't believe in that. Don't tell me about dead white European males, for example. That's not allowed in our university. And therefore, what's happened is we have a deprived population. You could not do this to my generation while we were running the show. You couldn't do it. Our generation was not that stupid. My generation committed a lot of crimes. And they're actual crimes. They're moral crimes. They submitted to things they should not have tolerated. They capitulated to public opinion, or what they thought was public opinion, which is generally manufactured by a billionaire mass media, not to their own consciences. But you couldn't have fooled us the way this baby boomer generation has been fooled. Now, our problem, and my problem in particular, is to speak like an old prophet who comes from my generation, which is about as close as we get to sanity these days. And my job is to tell you, who predominantly represent a younger generation, that once upon a time, we knew better than what you believe today. We would never have accepted globalization. We would never have accepted shipping our jobs overseas and taking them away from us. We would never have accepted these ideas of destroying infrastructure, this sort of thing. We wouldn't have tolerated it. But you, the younger generation, have. You've now considered the toothpaste that you can't put back in the tube. You go along with it. And some of us who are older and wiser and have the benefit of experience and have a tendency to look back to our ancestors too and think about our situation in respect to people who came before us, people who were born in the last century, the 19th century, that is. I can go back about 200 years in terms of my family experience, in terms of dinner table personalities, cultural contacts. Goes back to, I had an ancestor who was dinner table topic, who was born at the same time as Abraham Lincoln. There are many people of my generation who think in those terms, who think in terms, they can think in terms of family background back to the 18th century or the early 19th century. They have a sense of the present in terms of things that have happened over these intervening generations. They compare things in the long term. They think of where we came from and ask, where are we going? Now, we have before us an opportunity. If folks of the younger generation will come to their senses and realize The present political parties in the United States need them to work. There are some decent people in those parties, decent leading people. But the parties as organized institutions now under their present conditions of getting along with each other, they just don't work. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party are equally stupid and incompetent. You would think there's no chance of saving this nation if you think ahead and think that if these parties in that present constitution, that present state of mind, if they are going to run the future, even the immediate future, there is no chance for this nation or this civilization. But there are things we can do if people will come to their senses. If they realize, if they have an epiphany, maybe the majority of Americans will be better at taking an epiphany than George Bush was after September 11th. Maybe they'll take one that sticks and realize they came close to destruction of everything they'd fought for. And maybe they will change their ways or be willing to change their ways because they find certain values are more important to them than sticking to their old habits. They might want to change. The first thing they might want to do is go back to, as I said at the onset here, go back to what the United States once represented under Franklin Roosevelt and continued to represent in a certain significant degree during the first 20 years after his death. And say that was a better way of doing things. Why don't we take that as a point of reference and tell the baby boomers, look, it was better under those conditions. That's how you were able to get to college, because of us and because of these policies. If you've been like the children today, who had almost no chance, they can get to a college, but they can't get anything out of it. There's nothing in there to take. We can change. Now, we have to change in the way we think about the world. Unfortunately, we live under a British monarchical cultural influence, a Hobbesian influence. We think the secret of everything is how do you get ahead at the expense of the other fellow? People say, well, don't our interests compete with those of other nations? Don't they conflict? How can we beat these other nations? Idiots talk about a conflict between Europe and the United States and the question of economy. There is no such conflict except in the mind of idiots. There's no conflict between the euro and the dollar. The euro's bankrupt and the dollar's bankrupt. What's the conflict? We have to think in terms of humanity. And we have to understand that the nation state is a necessary institution because it's only through references to a national culture that a people can deliberate together efficiently on highly sensitive questions. But at the same time, the nations must deliberate as a family of nations. And the nations must agree upon policies among nations, as we in a nation must agree upon policies among ourselves based on our language culture, our traditions, the things we can share with our neighbors and friends and family, so that we can make references which people understand, which is more difficult for people who live in different countries with different cultures. But we are all human. We all have essentially the same interests as human beings. We have the same distinction from the animals that every other human being has. We are human. We have access to immortality, to ideas, which no animal has, except as they're adopted by a human being. An animal dies. Where does it go? Nowhere, unless some human being loved it. Where is a human being going when they die? If they were a person of ideas, a person who contributed to the development of a person with ideas, they have an immortality in the transmission of these cognitive discoveries and ideas which they transmit. What they have done as living human beings becomes a permanent part of humanity, a permanent legacy. They live forever in that legacy. They have immortality in that legacy. When they look back to their ancestors and the cultures that came before them and think of the struggles which we have behind us in earlier generations, we try to think about bringing justice to those who were departed. We try to think about the injustice that were done and to do something now, which is an act of justice for those who suffered injustice before, and thus the living must provide justice for the dead. And the living must provide a future for coming generations. We have that kind of immortality. And therefore, let us think of the human family in those terms, as a families of sovereign nation states, of people who are based on that conception of themselves. And look at the world. What's the situation? Can we get out of this financial crisis? Yes, we can. It'll be hard work. It will be satisfying work, but hard work. We have a vast unemployment now of two kinds. We have the actual unemployment, the people who are unemployed or underemployed. We have people who are not counted, or people who also are employed, but they're employed in useless things. We have too many white-collar workers who are unskilled. They should be able to do something productive, not something unskilled, which they find difficult to justify as human beings. We have a vast labor pool of unemployed people. We have vast needs in infrastructure. Look at our cities. Look at our power systems. Look at our water management. Look at our environment in general. Look at our educational system. Look at the buildings. Look at the conditions of life, the basic infrastructure. Look at our healthcare system, which is almost broken down. Look at these things. We need these things fixed. And fixing them will be useful, worth being paid for. We can put the American people back to work in the sense that Franklin Roosevelt showed. You can put people back to work, and the result will be useful and beneficial for the nation. Did we lose money on the New Deal? No, the conditions of life of the American people and the economy were improved by the New Deal. The nation was saved. The standard of living was increased. The economic power and profitability of the nation was improved by the New Deal. That was not make work. That was not useless. We put people who are idle or wasted into employment to build the future. And they did build the future. Maybe not perfectly, but they built it. We have before us great opportunities in terms of technological progress. We can make revolutions in technology. We can't do it all at once because we don't have the people with the skills needed to do that rapidly. But we can crank up the space mission program. We can crank up other things that will put juice back into this economy. But we also have several great tasks before us.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche speaking to the President's Day Conference on February 16, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche addressing the President's Day Conference, February 16, 2002.
We have the Americas, for example, and that's simple. All you have to do is put the system back under a just mode, and the Americas can come back quite nicely. There are a lot of messes down there in Central South America, but that the way it was once supposed to work will work if we put our minds to it. We have also two other areas of the world that are most important to us. And I'm not ignoring Australia, but the Australians can speak for themselves. They've known to be able to do so. You have Eurasia, the vast Eurasian continent, which is the greatest sources of mineral resources on this planet. Most of these untapped or virtually untapped. This includes Western Europe, which used to be a concentration of technological progress. This includes Japan, which was, until it was ruined by Brzezinski, was also a fountain of technological progress, until Brzezinski ruined it when he was National Security Advisor, controlling Carter. We have China, which is emerging, but which is not, by itself, is not doing too well, because China has over 1 billion people, well over 1 billion people, And it's not going to deal with that problem of population merely by the means it's applying now. It needs help. You have India, which is approaching 1 billion people. It also is a strong nation in some respects, but it needs help. You have Southeast Asia in general. You have Central and North Asia. You have the Middle East. These are areas of potential development which require large infusions of modern technology, capital-intensive investments of a period of 15 to 25 years, like big water projects and things like that, transportation projects. Therefore, we can rebuild Eurasia by combining those centers of Eurasia, including centers in China and in India, which have a technological potential for producing capital goods and technologies needed desperately by the vast masses of Asia, which are underdeveloped, and by areas of Asia, such as Central and North Asia, which have never been adequately developed, but which could be developed with programs which we've specified. Therefore, we have the means in this area. If we get an economic recovery program of the type that Roosevelt envisaged for the United States in the 1930s, for Eurasia, we can combine the idle potential of Japan, of Western Europe and other locations, and parts of China and India. We can take that potential and mobilize it to deliver in the long-term credit the technology required by the vast masses of Asia, including the masses of people and the masses of areas such as Central and North Asia, which are areas of largely untapped resources which cannot be tapped without development. We have also the case of Africa, which is a different case in some respects. Africa is a looted and destroyed continent, especially sub-Saharan Africa. Roosevelt intended to change that, but with Truman's accession, who didn't understand the problems of African people, that was dropped. Now, Africa is now looted. It's being looted largely as a area of raw materials. It's one of South African Shield. It's one of the richest source of mineral resources of this planet. It also has other natural so-called potentials. The Anglo-Americans and their Israeli partners have been looting that part of the world massively, looting it and destroying what remained of nation states, to loot the people, to set forth wars, fratricidal wars, and things of that sort in that part of the world. The people are destroyed. They're looted to death. We have to bring justice to Africa. Now, our part, Africa has tremendous potential. It has large mineral resources, which it could develop, not simply to export raw materials, but to export finished materials and semi-finished materials of its own production, to develop its own towns and industries. What it needs to do this is a very rapid injection of a large-scale major trunk infrastructural system. This is an old story. In the 1890s, the British planned to build a railway system from Cape Town to Cairo. Never was built. The French, until 1898, had planned to build a railroad across the sub-Sahel region from Senegal, Dakar in Senegal, to Djibouti on the Indian Ocean. Never built. There's a need for combined water systems, power systems, and transportation systems, and also new urban areas throughout Africa as a precondition for the development of Africa. Under the conditions provided by such infrastructure development, Africa has one of the great food-producing potentials of the world. It's active farms. But the farms are not productive for reasons of diseases, for lack of technology to make these areas fertile and productive. We have a vast market, a requirement for food in the burgeoning populations of South and East Asia. So therefore, there is a future for Africa. We have to give them that future. We have to give them, as Roosevelt projected, the basic economic infrastructure, the aid to develop that, the ability of them to maintain their own system and build their own system. That we have to do. So therefore, we can say that over the next quarter century, we as Americans, if we come to our senses, and we still are a political power in the world, if we could do things right, the world would listen to us. Africa would listen to us. I think Africa would trust me. I think Central and South America would trust me, would probably not trust any other candidate in the United States. For good reason, too. They're not dumb. Europe and Asia would probably trust me, but would trust no other figure in the United States. If the United States, as I understand it, would offer this option to the people of the Americas, Africa, and Eurasia, we could say that we can adopt a 25-year mission, not for some kind of imperialism, not some kind of hegemonic system. We can organize a partnership among perfectly sovereign nation states, which might be called a multipolar world, a multipolar world of cooperation among nation states. All it requires at this point is leadership of vision under conditions of great crisis, as Roosevelt reacted in 1932-33 to the Depression in the United States. A leader of vision and understanding who's willing to break glass, the glass imprisonment of popular opinion, and say, we are going to hell. Would you like to survive? Will you join me in surviving? And what I need from you and from many other people is a simple yes. We want to do it. We have a great vision before us. 25 years of coming out of hell to a future. And we who are not going to live to see it can think 50 years ahead, two generations, and say, at last, we have within our reach the possibility of establishing an order on this planet which is fit for the human beings and all of the human beings who live in it. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to begin with a question from the United States that has been submitted by a staff member who is listening from the Congressional Black Caucus. As we proceed today, we will be taking questions both from the United States and from around the world. There is a free period tomorrow when Mr. LaRouche will field questions from the audience. If there are people here who have questions today, who for one reason or another don't think that they will be able to ask their question tomorrow, you can see a member of the conference staff and they will forward your name to me and we'll try to see what we can arrange for you. Lynn, the first question from the Congressional Black Caucus is the following. Mr. LaRouche, you may or may not be familiar with Donna Brazile. She was on the staff of the Congressional Black Caucus. She was chief of staff to Washington, D.C.'s delegate Eleanor Holmes Norton, and of course, she went on to chair Al Gore's Y2K presidential campaign. At the time, we were proud to have a black woman serving in such a high capacity. However, today, we find that Donna Brazile is working as a paid lobbyist for John McCain in a drive to implement his campaign finance reform bill. While we of the Black Caucus oppose soft money and the way that it is used to manipulate policy, we also fear that campaign finance reform will be yet another weapon in the effort to harass and intimidate black elected officials. Mr. LaRouche, can you tell us what's going on? Was Donna Brazile a submarine in the Congressional Black Caucus?
Well, Uncle Tom's Cabin. This is a dangerous situation. The questioner does not exaggerate the significance of it. What we have is, see, this Joe Lieberman business. Joe Lieberman, Al Gore, Al Fromm, David Frum, the guy who put the axis of hate into the president's speech, which was then changed slightly by a speechwriter to axis of evil. I mean, axis of evil. David Frum, who's part of the same collaboration. Now, this goes back, if you recall, to the beginning of the year 2000, New Hampshire, in which a dog and pony show, that is, the dog was Al Gore, the pony was McCain, were used in a 1-2 punch to eliminate all possible candidates for the presidential nomination except McCain, George W. Bush, and Al Gore. That was the operation. So the election was rigged at that point. And Joe Lieberman was a key part of the rigging. Because Al Gore, as you probably know, cannot think. Unfortunately, Lieberman can, and that makes him dangerous. I don't think McCain can actually think either. But he's also dangerous when he's tied to Joe Lieberman. What you have is if you look at their policy record over this period, McCain and Lieberman represent exactly what I described as the clash of civilizations policy. Remember that Brzezinski is nominally a Democrat. That doesn't mean much. But also that Brzezinski, like McCain, is crazy. I mean, you saw McCain's behavior at a security conference in Munich or read the speech, the man is not all there. Or there are some extra parts which are unaccounted for in the device. One of the two, either way. So this guy is dangerous. Now, what this means, now he's campaigning on what? They've been talking about, the New Yorker ran an article on the so-called Bull Moose campaign, which I call the Loose Goose campaign or the Bull Goose campaign, saying, in effect, that McCain and also implicitly Lieberman and Donna Brazile are key members of something that's intended to prevent an honest election of any sort from occurring in the next period, and even worse. That this group, the loose goose policy or the bull goose policy, is going to act as a blackmail force upon the Clinton administration, I mean the Bush administration, and what remains of the Democratic Party for this entire period. You see that in the way that this campaign financing cleanup reform was made. What kind of reform? It's called reform school. You can't get in the party unless you're a criminal. What this means is that now, most of you know, and people in the Black Congressional Caucus are particularly sensitive to this, others are as well, and that is that how do you fund a slate of candidates for state and federal offices in the United States? How do you fund a slate? Now, some candidates can attract a lot of money. Other candidates cannot, as individual candidates. Therefore, to get a slate that represents the entire party across the board on a state level or a national level, you must have an open contribution system in which the party can intend subsidize the chosen candidates. So therefore, the pre-primary process the primary process can develop these candidates. Once they are selected, then the party has the ability to put out the financial backing to provide full slate backing for all candidates. Now, if you don't have that, and particularly when you're talking about candidates who represent poor people or people who are poorer, and you can't get the money to them, you can't go out there and raise enough money for them to make them really competitive against big money. It can't be done. Which means you would narrow the selection to a few big bucks people who would control the entire process. That means that what little remains of democracy in either of the two parties would actually, as a matter of fact, go out the window. So this was a swindle, but it was, I must say, duly bought and paid for. And you have the Congress to show it. I mean, look at the campaign contributions. How many candidates, how many incumbents in the Congress were on the pad of Enron and similar institutions? How much money did their campaign require? How many bills for Enron coming out of the Enron task force were rammed through the Congress with these congressmen who were bought and paid for, or wish to be bought and paid for, or go along to get along. So you had, now this Enron operation is actually, as I said, a criminal operation. It is intrinsically criminal. When I referred to the case of Captain Kidd at the beginning of the 18th century, a case I studied over 60 years ago when I was still an academic student. A pirate is privateering. The case of Captain Kidd, the facts are never quite that clear. But what is clear is this privateering operation did take a ship. They were a privateer, a licensed British privateer. And it's a fact that when he came back without the money to his sponsor, who was the governor of Massachusetts colony at that time, and he didn't have the guilt, they shipped him off to London to be hung, Captain Kidd, the famous case of Captain Kidd. But this was typical of the period of privateering, where you would farm out something that ought to be controlled by a government, the conduct of war, you'd farm warfare out to private interests, mercenary interests. And these guys were not functioning on the paid basis, they were functioning on shares of what they could steal as privateers. Now what's Enron? Look at what it is. Look at what comes out now, begins to leak out in Enron and other cases. And you're gonna find many of them, they're coming down, the cluster is busting. Is absolute criminality. How was this possible? Well, the Congress voted for it. You had Wendy Graham and her husband, Bill Graham, the man with the Graham-sized brain, and the only man who's dumber than Milton Friedman among economists. And these crooks were designing legislation which was rammed through the Congress, which authorized this kind of absolute criminality. They created loopholes, criminal loopholes. So don't say, talking about the shareholders and employees' pensions of Enron. This is like talking about the payroll of a pirate crew. A guy's committed piracy, he's raped and robbed most of the people of the United States, as in California, for example. And this guy now wants his pension. I was an honest pirate. I killed and slaughtered for pay. I am entitled to my sharehold. What about the people who denied medical care? The people who had no pensions whatsoever because of this swindle? What about the companies that went under? What about the pensions that were taken out of other people? In California, for example, the California case is well documented, where Enron and similar operations are responsible for this. And the same Congress which allowed Enron to exist and things like Enron robbed the healthcare system of the country and actually is murdering people in the United States as we stand and sit here now as a result of those changes in healthcare, authorized by the Congress. And therefore, the implication of this Donna Brazile thing is prostitution, outright prostitution. Well, I like John McCain. The guy's a raving lunatic. What do you like about him? What's he, your sexual preference or something? And Eleanor Holmes Norton, she's a case. She's a case. These are the kind of, remember, what is the history behind Eleanor Holmes Norton? You had a group of people, Amelia knows about this thing very well. She's a first-hand source on this stuff. When Martin Luther King was campaigning, there were a group of people who were hired by the racists to try to stop Martin Luther King. And this group of people was rewarded by being promoted into various kinds of careers in various parts of the United States. Eleanor Holmes Norton was part of it. Donna Brazile was her woman, whatever that means. And this is typical. Williams is the same thing. Mayor Williams of Washington, the same thing. A thief who shut down a hospital in Boston in the same way. These are murderers. They say, well, I'm black. Was that a qualification for crime? A license for crime? Now, when the questioner asked, now this is very serious, and this little thing about a so-called reform of campaign contributions is a case of corruption, and something has to be done about it. But I think the first thing to do is people have got to wake up. You know, the problem that worries me among African Americans, so-called, it's a name, it doesn't mean anything. To me, they're just Americans. Usually victimized, but that's all right. We've all been victimized too. But the thing that gets me about this is that when this is known, how can people go out and take money from what they're known to be corrupt and say, oh, I need the money for my constituents? What's the difference between an African-American representative doing that and the members of the Congress who made this Enron criminality with wide open eyes made this possible? Because when they change the rules, they organize and legalize crime. Now they're complaining about the crime and saying, is this an individual case? $100 trillion worth? No, it's not.
Let me just read you quick greetings that we've received. This is from the chairman of the UCR, who is also a member of the National Assembly in Armenia, as well as the deputy chairman, also a member of the National Assembly. Their names are Rant Khachaturian and Haik.
Armenia?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Babukanyan. These are just greetings, but I would like to read them to you. It says, Dear Mr. LaRouche and dear participants of the annual President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute and International Caucus of Labor Committees. Please accept our greetings and best wishes to your conference on behalf of the Constitutional Rights Union of Armenia. We wish you productive work, and we believe you are capable of putting into full operation the fundamental ideas of Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt to continue the American Revolution. We wish to express our solidarity and our deep friendship with you. So we'd like to thank them for that. Lynn, I have a question from St. Petersburg, Russia, from Konstantin Cheremink, who works as a journalist there and who also has been a collaborator. Dear Lynn, a day after the collapse of Kaiser Aluminum, Russia's Minister of Economic Development is trying to convince our parliament that Russia has to join the World Trade Organization. Why? Because the process of globalization of markets is increasing in the whole world. The weeks before, Central Moscow papers were emphasizing that Russia's economy is less damaged than others with what is now called a recession, as it is not completely integrated into the globalized economy. Using the expression of Pavel Milyukov, who in late 1916 said, is that idiocy or is that treason? I'd like you to comment.
Well, what you had is in the Republican, International Republican Institute moved in on Russia when the former President George Bush was in charge. And what they brought in was a pack of thieves, Alibaba style. And these thieves are called liberals. And they stole liberally, very liberally. They robbed the joint. They are now called the oligarchy, the financial oligarchy. They stole everything in sight. Now, remember that Russia was a vast storehouse, and the Soviet Union was a vast storehouse of accumulated physical wealth, as well as intellectual wealth. Scientists, for example, who were taken over. The United States, for example, it depends largely upon Russian scientists, former Soviet scientists, who brought in to the United States to fill the holes in the heads of American scientists. So other things. So the raw materials of Russia were looted. The industries of Russia were shut down. Russia was made a market for dumping products which it used to produce but no longer produces. And therefore, Russia was looted. Now, these oligarchs are the sponsors of this kind of same thing that's killing the United States, the World Trade Organization, part of the globalization process. It never should have existed. It is a piece of thievery. It is a potential Enron on a grand scale. And it should be shut down because it's thievery. It's against moral law. And therefore, if somebody in Russia says, well, we should join the WTO because of the collapse of Kaiser Aluminum, you have to say, here's another thief running out. And he should be called a thief. Because by now, anybody in Russia who makes such a statement should be easily recognized as one of the thieves who looted the joint, who increased the death rate, lowered the rate of life expectancy, and so forth and so on in that country. Any Russian who proposes such a measure, after all the experience of the past 12 years, would have to be considered morally a traitor to his people.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting Lyndon LaRouche speaking to the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute, February 16, 2002. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.